joining the stage now. I'd like to first of all welcome the moderator, Daniel Cordy, who will introduce the panel. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. It's the very last panel of the day, the very last panel of the conference. So as it is, the most important is always at the end. And if you see the screen, our delegation, the delegation of builders, contractors, the industry, is very well represented. And I'm very pleased to be here. And thank you for the invitation to moderate this panel. My name is Daniel Cordy. I'm the chairman of a new association, an association called Association of Global Event Suppliers. AGES, the shortcut, stands for a quality label in this industry, which is becoming bigger and more important. Label also for reliability and safety. The mission of this association is to promote temporary and demountable infrastructure, but also to support governmental bodies, organizers in finding smart infrastructure solutions and cost-effective solutions. Before becoming a chairman, I was for 20 years an executive director of one of the members, Nestlé, and we have a representative of that company in the panel. Infrastructure requirements have become tremendously important, increased because of requirements from federations, from media, from security, other stakeholders too. So it is more and more a key for a host city and a challenge also to deal with this. We spoke about Agenda 2020 and Transformation 22. So there is a change process going on, and as some of you might know, the IOC also is a change in the mindset, going away from imposing fixed seat requirements for different sports. So there is a change mode, and I think it's also, you know, if we were speaking yesterday about dope, corruption, tainting our, you know, sports events, but also culture events. In our world, the world of infrastructure, we also have these buzzwords about white elephants or cost increase. So the panel is to deal also about these subjects. I would like to introduce my panelists here, and I'm very pleased to have a delegation representing different stakeholders. There is Christopher Lee. Chris is a senior principal at Populous, a world leader in sport architecture. He has worked around the globe for high-profile sports clients and on major international sports events, designing over 30 stadia on six continents, including Sydney 2000, Millennium Stadium, or the Arsenal Emirates Stadium. I have Andy Priest. He's a director, economics, sports, Europe, Middle East, and Africa from AECOM. Andy brings 25 years of consulting experience in the sport, major event, and tourism sector. His specific experience cover areas such as stadia, sports tourism, high performance sports, and others. Andy has helped cities, local organizing committees, and international federations to evaluate, bid for, plan for, and deliver major events. There is Ian McKenzie. He is an architect and a director of McKenzie Sports Architecture. Previously, he was head of venue and village development and integration at Glasgow 2014, the organizing company for the 2014 Commonwealth Games. He was a member of the BID team to secure the Commonwealth Games for Glasgow, and he's also a long-time member of the International Union of Architects, Sports and Leisure Work Group. And finally, but not least, Reto Ray. Reto has been working with Nestlé since 2007 and took a role as the head of business development in 2014. He's a member of the group management and responsible for planning, tendering, strategic sales, and marketing. Reto has been responsible for various international projects like the FIFA World Cup in South Africa or the Crystal Hall in Baku, Azerbaijan. So this is the panelist, and I'll be joining you with... I hope it works, yes. So we were preparing this panel and thought that we would leave the room for an opening statement, kind of the observation from different angles in the industry. And I would ask with Chris from Populous, maybe, what are your observations? What has changed, or what's in the change mode now?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, I think part of what we were talking about earlier is about bidding and cities bidding and why cities or countries bid for events. And I think really the discussion we'd been having was about why would a city or a country bid for an event. And I think the most successful events, be they Olympics, World Cups, you name it, are ones where there is a clarity of vision, where the country or the city knows why they're bidding, has a very clear vision of why they're bidding and what they want to put on. I see Mike Lee's just left, but Mike's certainly a very integral part of that clarification of a vision. And then what that vision then drives what the event is, how it is, how it happens, and most importantly, what the legacy of that event is, both in a physical sense, what do we need, what does a city, the country, infrastructure-wise, social economic-wise, and then that is almost reversed back to what we do as architects and designers to design the venues or design the event overlay that fits within that vision, that is all about the clarity and delivering the event and then the legacy post-event that leaves the city or the country in a better place than before the event.
Thank you, Chris. Andy, from your perspective, what have you come across? What's your observations?
I'm probably the odd person out on the panel. I'm the serious grey-suited economist wedged here between my two design colleagues. Unsurprisingly, my concern, my passion is around the financial sustainability of venues. And in broad terms, we're doing better, for sure. But we still see an awful lot of venues being built that are too big in the wrong place and just haven't been thought through. And it particularly came to mind yesterday with one of yesterday's panels. I'm not sure if the gentleman from FIFA is still here. Doesn't look like it. But the observation was, you know, we're doing some work at the moment with a couple of the Russian World Cup 2018 host cities. And, you know, unfortunately, they are ending up with excessively large stadiums in a couple of locations in generally non-footballing communities. And, you know, the residents of those cities, we talked yesterday about citizen engagement, you know, will be paying for those venues for 30, 40 years to come. And we can help them with sort of business planning and securing an operator, but it's really a bit late in the day. You know, the thought process in terms of is it the right thing to do to encourage, support, whatever you want to call it, cities to develop stadia of that scale in relatively small communities, and in some cases where they're already existing stadia. And, you know, so the conference is about events, and I'm as passionate as anybody about major events, but I'm more concerned about the 99% of time that venues are not in major event use, because that's what drives financial sustainability.
Thank you for this time. Ian, I mean, you've been following the Glasgow experience, if I may call it that, from day one to the end. But you also traveled a lot and seen many events. So what is your reflection on that?
I think probably say more about the Glasgow experience, which I think does demonstrate good planning. In terms of venue provision, the approach taken by the bid team and followed through by the organising committee was that we'd maximise the use of existing infrastructure, whether that was sports infrastructure or other facilities that existed within the city or elsewhere in Scotland if that was necessary. To look at that, maximise the use, look again and see if any of these needed adaptation that would be cost effective and have a legacy value, and where we did need new facilities, that these should fit into a strategy, and some of them fitted into a sports strategy, some were business strategies of other organisations, and in all cases they needed a business plan to show that they were sustainable in the longer term. If the venues didn't fit into those categories, then the option was then to provide a temporary venue, because to build something that you then had to pay for that you didn't need is the classic white elephant. And an example, or one of the challenges we had, was where we were going to host the track and field events. And as most people will know, we chose Hampden, converted Hampden, the National Football Stadium, into the venue. And just in the short time I have, I'll briefly say why and how. And why was, well, we needed a venue that could accommodate 40,000 spectators. Glasgow has a very good athletics track, international standard, but the existing grandstands would accommodate maybe 6,000 people. Add in some temporary seats and we'd get a little above 10,000, maybe a little more, but a long way short of what we needed. Glasgow, as has already been mentioned this morning, has three football stadia, all with a capacity of 50,000 or greater. And we decided on Hampden for a number of reasons. One was that it was an oval shape, so it lent itself to conversion. It had good access to the field of play and underneath the stadium between the two tunnels. And it had space in Lesser Hampden with some work and considerable work to create the warm-up track. And how we did it, although Hampden had a bowl shape, the area of the field of play was well short of what's needed for a modern athletics track. And the way to overcome that was to raise the field of play. And after looking at that, we decided the optimum height was about 1.9 metres, which meant covering the first eight rows of seats. And again, looking at the options for doing that, we decided on a suspended deck. That had never been done before in a stadium. The system existed. It had never held world-class athletics on it. So these were risks, and we mitigated that by testing it out. And then the deck went in. Then after the deck was in, it was just straightforward track construction above that. And then it all came out again afterwards, and we returned Hampden to Hampden Park Limited and the SFA for football use. But the track material was reused and has been relaid in two tracks around Scotland, one here in Glasgow, and is used daily, and another one in Grangemouth, which is a key track for development in Scotland. So, and the system itself is reused elsewhere.
Thank you. And that's a very smart way to deal with infrastructure challenges. Reto, from your perspective, I mean, you're representing the industry of suppliers. What are your observations in the past now? What have you seen come across all these major events?
If I may start with the Agenda 2020, which obviously has been named quite a few times the last 2 days. I mean, there are 40 recommendations, and for temporary suppliers or for specialists like us, obviously there are three which are I think quite important, and there's number four, which means include sustainability in all aspects. That means obviously also infrastructure. I will come to that and maybe later. And then there's one, obviously, to move from a sport event program more to sport-based program, more to an event-based program, which obviously includes the development of the federations in the last few years to develop their sport to make it more attractive. So also there we can support with some innovative products or venues. And then last but not least, obviously, it's, as Andy mentioned as well, always about cost. So is there any possibility to reduce cost with temporary structures? Not necessarily, but it might. So there are different aspects. And if you were asking me about the tendency the last maybe few years, if I just pick the World Cup, for instance, if we compare South Africa, there were stadiums built, and we know there are unfortunately a few which are now white elephants, but nevertheless there were from all these seats being built on a permanent basis, out of those were 6% were temporary seats. That's the first time that the World Cup used temporary seats in stadiums. And then in Brazil it was already 9%, so a slight increase. Now in Russia, although I agree with the statement of Christopher from Populus or Andy about there could be more temporary seats being built in a sustainable aspect or for a legacy, at least there are already 14% of the seats being temporary at the end, hopefully. And we don't need to mention Qatar, which is the plan of using 50% of the seats on a temporary basis. So there is a tendency from FIFA, also from the World Cup, but also, as we have mentioned quite a few times, London 2012, Malcolm mentioned from a security perspective, might not be the best Olympic Games ever, but in my opinion, in terms of using existing infrastructure or using temporary structures, in my opinion, was the best. There was mention this morning about the temporary venue. I think, Roland, you mentioned it, the basketball venue. At least it was a good concept, maybe not to the end, but we can maybe discuss that later why. And there were other very beautiful venues which you would not identify as temporary structures. So. Also there, this movement was started in 2012, and now obviously with the Agenda 2020 has been enforced to follow up that tendency in the future.
Thank you, Reto, for this observation. So obviously it's still, there are white elephants around and pictures we see somewhere of empty stadiums or certainly not a smart solution. So if we go back at the very beginning, Chris, a question to you, because if a bid city or a candidate city starts to develop the infrastructure program, what is the smart way? What are you advising these representatives, city representatives or urban planners to do in order to avoid these white elephants and these impacts which are not necessary?
Well, I think it sort of comes back to my opening remark about clarity of vision. Why are they hosting an event? Why do they want to bid for an event? What do they want to get out of that particular event, both in the event, but most importantly, what the legacy of that event is? So I think it's and this is where politics gets involved in legacy, and what the appropriate legacy is might not be the most politically expedient legacy, but there's a need to genuinely assess what the legacy is, and I'm sure Andy can pick this up, or Rita, on is it a permanent venue, is it a temporary venue? And I think as an architect and designer of stadiums and sports events, I don't think it matters. From an infrastructure perspective, I think you can produce incredible bits of architecture, fantastic sporting venues that may only be there for 6 weeks. I mean, I think beach volleyball in London 2012 was a perfect example of that. It went up in a month. We had an incredible game with, you know, the backdrop of London, beach volleyball in central London, and it was gone in 6 weeks for the Queen's Jubilee. So one can produce fantastic events and fantastic bits of architecture, incredible experiences for the spectators and the athletes themselves that don't necessarily need to be permanent if there isn't a requirement for a permanent venue in the legacy business case. So I think that's the smart approach to bidding is clarity of vision and a genuine understanding of what the real legacy is, the legacy case is.
Okay, well, so you don't have a conflict then as an architect, if I understand you, Chris. I mean, on one side, you know, the perception of Populous is these iconic, big, beautiful stadiums. And on the other side, you see these cities struggling with finance and getting that done. You have the pressure of the taxpayers. So how do you deal with this? It's not only just about permanent and temporary, it's just about, you know, cost efficiency. So isn't it a conflict sometimes for you?
No, I don't think it's a conflict, and I think we had a previous discussion, which is a great one for designers love to talk about, of iconic architecture and what is iconic architecture, and quite often major international events demand a level of iconic architecture. They want the postcard, they want that vision broadcast around the world, and part of many bidding cities or host cities is that world presence, the postcard view, and iconic architecture is used as one of the leverage tools for achieving that. But I don't think one should confuse iconic architecture with novel architecture. And in my perception as a designer, a great building or great architecture is a building that is iconic, it's identifiable as a piece of architecture, but it serves its purpose perfectly. There is function and there is form following function. And I think the two get confused between novelty and great architecture quite often. So I think the sort of shorter answer is, I think you can produce great iconic architecture, permanent or temporary, depending on the legacy business case.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Well, let's speak a little bit about costs, Andy. That's the other point, you know, about the accountability, increasing costs, and bad news in this respect. So how would you advise an organizing committee to deal with monitoring costs? And how do they secure that it, from day one to the end, there is a good control of the costs?
I think part of the issue goes back, you have to go back in terms of the stages of the process, and I'm going to draw on Glasgow as a good practice or even best practice example here. And there still aren't enough event bids that are informed by a robust feasibility study. And again, no surprise as the economist in the room that that's something I would endorse. But it's something that Glasgow, you know, Glasgow made the decision to bid based on a very detailed feasibility study that looked at the technical feasibility in terms of venues, it looked at the costs and the benefits to the city and the country, and it looked at, I think what the time was called winnability, so probability of success. And the government, the executive, made a decision to support the bid on the basis of that feasibility study. So they were making the decision with their eyes open, if you like, about the costs and the benefits in particular. And you know, we still see, I think, too many bids that are, and we probably never get away from this, but are very politically driven, and it's just an announcement, we're going to bid for this, without having the benefit, if you like, of that really detailed insight, and certainly in terms of Glasgow that they had, to make the decision to commit the funding for the bid process and commit the funding to host the event with a kind of full understanding of the costs and the benefits. And obviously part of that process is putting together a budget for the bid process and a budget for hosting the event at the same time. And the challenge then after that is obviously monitoring against that budget, but at least you're starting from a point, an informed point, whereas unfortunately a lot of the major events we still see around the world, they're off and running without having the benefit of that insight.
All right, thank you. Well, I'm curious to know, is there a tendency with financing projects you've come across? I mean, is it public money is short or getting shorter? And when you are dealing with these organizing committees, what are your observations? Is it going into new financing models of infrastructure?
I mean, the shortage of public finance funding is a major challenge at the moment. Certainly, we're still seeing a lot of major venues procured through public-private partnerships. For anybody that's not familiar with it, the Singapore Sports Hub is a good example to look at. I think the largest sports infrastructure public-private partnership still in the world opened this year. You know, perhaps a scale that may not be relevant to all, but in terms of the principles behind it, the public-private partnership principles, certainly worth looking at. The real challenge we're finding is in less developed countries and continents, in Africa in particular, where I'm doing a fair bit of work at the moment, and securing funding for major sporting or any sporting venue there is a real challenge. Traditionally, it was the Chinese money that was supporting those developments, less and less, so that's not available. So we're having to be creative and think about engaging the development banks and those types of institutions. But their priorities are around health, education. You know, that's where they want to put their money. So we then have to think about how do we adapt sporting venues to deliver those kind of wider social objectives and therefore become eligible for that type of funding. So we've got to become, as I say, particularly in places like Africa, a lot more creative about the funding solutions for sporting venues.
Thank you, Andy. Ian, I'm curious to know, I mean, if what would be the key learnings from your perspective looking into the delivery of infrastructure, and more specifically, how did you experience the engagement with the suppliers on the case of Glasgow?
Okay, probably two different answers to that one, or there's two different questions in there. One, in terms of, and picking up on Andy's point about the strategic decisions, and for example, the Emirates Arena was part of the National Regional Sports Facility strategy, so it was a venue that was going to be built irrespective of the success of the Games. I think where Glasgow's planning came in really well was to locate it in the East End Regeneration development area on a site next to where the Athletes' Village was going to be, where there was infrastructure going in terms of services and utilities, also the East End Regeneration route, the new road that was being built, upgrading of public transport. And you know, you suddenly have a whole massive development there that all complements each other and lives off each other, so that the individual developments benefit from the investment in the other areas. I think the other important fact from Glasgow's point of view was that it wanted a major sports facility in an area of priority in terms of getting increased participation. And that's been borne out already by in the Glasgow Club, 60% of the membership of the Glasgow Club using the venue are from within 2 miles of the venue. So, you know, that's a good success. It's also, at the same time, hosted, within the 2 years it's been opened, over 160 international events, national or international events. And a good number of these have been high-profile, televised events. But day-to-day, it's a community sports centre in many parts of the building. And to locate the velodrome as part of that as well was another add-on to it, where the velodrome can operate as a velodrome rather than have this conflict where most standalone velodromes have, how do we use the infield? So there's a lot of very good and clear thinking about what was happening, a business plan that backed that up. And I think that's the sort of, just to reinforce what Christopher and Andy have said about the clear thinking, then once you have that, then all your decisions after that can be taken in the context of that, and you can always reference back to why are we doing it and can we justify doing this? And you should always be reviewing because circumstances change.
Thank you. And then coming back a bit to the second part of the question, when you know you have a phase to plan, to procure and to deliver. So That I would like to understand a bit how you experienced that.
Yeah, I think again, you know, the approach was that if you're having a Games in Glasgow in Scotland, then you want Glasgow and Scottish businesses to benefit as much as possible. And Glasgow set up a business portal. Now that didn't exclude companies from outside Glasgow, but it allowed companies to know what packages were coming on scale on board, when they were likely to come, and also information days so companies could find out how they could engage with the business and get business. There was also within that a kind of community benefit clause where companies took on apprentices to train up the workforce and upskill the workforce locally. But when you do put on an event as big as the Commonwealth Games or even much bigger, the Olympics, then you're not going to be able to resource that from within your own boundaries. You do need national and international experts to come in and help, and companies who have that expertise have been able to put in the temporary infrastructure and run that. So it's getting the balance right, you know, so that people don't think all the money's leaving the country and going out, but equally that you have the confidence that you're going to put on a world-class event.
Thank you. Reto, from your perspective, I mean, what are the true innovations? I mean, we all know, you know, they're tents and they're 20-meter span, 30-meter span, but still a tent. There are other products we've come across on all these events. So where is the industry moving? What are the true innovations then in the industry from your point of view?
Very good question, Daniel. Obviously, it's not, I think innovation is not about the product itself or the development of the product. Of course, we want to be always faster, cheaper, and more efficient with the material. But I think the innovation is more about how you can use those temporary structures to optimize maybe existing venues, like expand them or reuse them or transform them. Or even have nevertheless iconic venues, as Chris said earlier, with temporary structures, so to help architects or host cities to develop a structure which could be used as a really iconic structure. I would maybe point out the last FINA World Championship, Swimming World Championship in Kazan. Obviously, it was a clear statement, as also Chris or Andy mentioned. They had a statement, they wanted to bring Kazan, the Russian city, onto the map, and they hosted the Swimming World Championship, but they did not have any swimming venue, huge venue. So the idea was to use a football stadium and transform that into a swimming hall. So how do you do that? Is it efficient? Is it cost efficient? They will use the venue afterwards for the football World Cup, of course. But this is, in my opinion, the innovation which comes from the host city. They had a clear idea. They knew somehow that it could be done, but they needed some support in the concept phase. And another example might be, as you might know, or hopefully you don't know, that Swiss teams not always perform very well globally, but at least we are world champion in tennis. And so Switzerland won the Davis Cup, and when obviously Switzerland hosted the semi-final, which was in Geneva, they wanted to have an event, a sport event, and the question was, what kind of venues can we use? And it was just an exhibition hall, normally used for the automotive industry. And we transformed that into a tennis hall with 17,000 spectators. So there's, I think, the innovation to use existing facilities or even use specific location to showcase the city. Maybe the last example, even though we have not built that one, but I think that really an iconic venue was used for, again, 2012 Olympics Horse Guards Parade, the beach volleyball venue. Very nice location, and you know it's going to be gone afterwards, so you can use that location with a permanent structure. It would never happen like this. So this is also innovation to use specific location to showcase the city.
Yeah. Thank you, Reto. So it's about time to maybe open up to the audience and ask you if you have some specific questions to the panel about infrastructure. We'll be happy to, yes, over there.
Alistair Beard from ICON. When you talk about temporary infrastructure, what you're really talking about is reuse. Otherwise, you're putting in so temporary infrastructure, then taking it out again. And what you're really doing is moving the risk of the capital expenditure from an organising committee to a supplier. And there's a number of suppliers, I'm sure, in this room who would have to make investment decisions based on the ability to reuse the capital that they've invested in. You have long-term contracts with people like the IOC, with FIFA, on revenue-generating activities, things like sponsorships, things like broadcast rights. Can you ever see a scenario where someone like the IOC would commit to a longer-term contract with an infrastructure provider that enables a supplier to invest and therefore balances the risk between the suppliers and someone like the IOC or FIFA?
To whom would you wish to ask the question to all? So who would like to answer?
Maybe I will start as a supplier. Obviously, this is or could be a model in the future if the IOC would commit themselves to a specific supplier. I guess this is not what they really tend to, as obviously if they choose one of the supplier, what happens with the others? And I think what they can do is just to promote that obviously temporary structures can be used the most efficient way. And what we try to do is to somehow show what material is already existing in the world, how that could be used so that no company has to invest a lot of new material and then use that only for these specific events. Maybe you were touching also the hall, the temporary basketball hall. Obviously, if that could be reused for other purposes, that could be an option then. And then you could say, okay, 2 years later, we have the Sochi Winter Olympics. May we use that, as I think it was mentioned also earlier, for a curling venue if there's no legacy plan. So I think this idea should be implemented within the IOC or maybe also FIFA, but not to pick a specific supplier and then to somehow have a partnership with them only. That's my personal opinion.
Thank you. Any other question? Yes, I know your question. It's about the basketball hall.
Thank you. Yes, only because it came in conversation yesterday and I learned it's called Hallmark Events. Those cities that have regular events of their own, and I think Hong Kong Sevens was described, I thought Edinburgh having its own festival, you never see these cities then host the travelling circus, and that's possibly because that would be hogging. However, there seems to me a good splice where it's efficient, it saves money because there's a lot of existing infrastructure in place. What's the panel's view on such a thing happening? Perhaps Andy, you can start.
Thank you, Roland. I think the point, the takeaway point from Roland's comment is that there are a whole range of different types of events that cities can host, and you know, we talked yesterday about business events, and there's cultural events and political events and sporting events has been the topic today, but in my view, the most successful cities encapsulate all of those types of events in a strategy, and they recognise the fact that different types of events bring different types of benefits. So, you know, a large political event like the G20 will bring different legacy benefits to a smaller sporting event, for example. And they bring different benefits at different stages of the event life cycle. So the cities and countries that I see doing best, if you like, at benefiting from events are those that recognize the fact that different types of events have different types of benefits and different types of legacies. They encapsulate those in a strategy, and they bid for events, the right events, for the right reasons. Yeah. So the sophisticated, if you like, cities and countries recognize the differences, and they bid based on the benefits that they want to generate. And the type of events that Roland's described, the hallmark events, are just part of that portfolio. And I think the most successful cities have a balanced portfolio. It's not necessarily just hallmark events and it's not just mega events, it's a whole range of different types of events because you get different benefits from those different events.
Thank you. So I take the last question. It's over there. The gentleman with the gray hair, looking young.
Thank you. Guy Lodge, I'm an infrastructure consultant currently with Rio, previously London and Vancouver. I guess one of the issues that I've got for the panel is it's one thing getting the legacy design right for the long term for a venue, because that's known at the time of the bid and what you want to do. The organizing committee has 54 functions that all have demands and requirements and often aren't captured. And what we run into time and time again is that the legacy development often doesn't encapsulate everything that we need to supply from a temporary perspective. Often the footprint is not there, the infrastructure inside the building is not there, and so the overlay costs start to spiral out of control. So one of the things that we continually push for is to try and get that permanent build to encapsulate much more of the temporary needs. But invariably, event after event, we find that we continually have this problem. So maybe throw that to Christopher as give some comments back.
Well, I think it's a great question, and there's the tension, I think, in these large-scale events between the split between the delivery organisation, who their remit is to deliver the base buildings, and the organising committee who put on the show deal with the temporary and the overlay works, and that constant tension between what's temporary, what's legacy, what's permanent, whose budget is it basically in? And the tendency is very much when cost pressures is on very standard on every project, that's an overlay issue. That's a legacy issue. We'll push it from our base build cost delivery organization into a legacy. Clearly from the other side as overlay designers, the push is clearly back in the other end. And there is this tension between delivering a major event with almost two organizations under the same hat, one delivering the base capital works, one putting on the event and everything that's needed towards it, and who's paying for what really is temporary and what really isn't. I don't think there's a simple answer to any of that. From a kind of sensible perspective, the legacy infrastructure requirements would be provided in the base build, and anything then, whether it's temporary infrastructure or temporary services, power, we looked yesterday, are provided as an overlay cost. But it's more art than science, as you know.
I think, can I just add to that? I think there's also the issue that you bid you're awarded the game 7 years out, and standards change during the time you come to implement in the last, 18 months to 12 months, you start putting that in. As we know, security can change the level of security and the risk, so that can change things overnight almost. Broadcasters want higher standards because the customers, when we are sitting in our living room watching the games, we want to see the reverse angle, we want to see the super slow motion. That means more lighting, and everything goes up and up. And I think the big challenge for everyone involved in the event industry is, how do we stop everything escalating? Because it does run away with money. When will we start to say that, no, we don't want 17,000 seats at swimming? It's ridiculous. You're so far away, you just want to be at the event. You'd be better staying at home or going to a fan zone and watching it there. It'd be a much better atmosphere. You'd have a better experience. So somewhere along the line, and I hope soon, that people can start to be sensible, because the impact on some of the permanent buildings, on the fact they do have to accommodate large spectator numbers afterwards, albeit they're in a temporary, is changing the nature of that building that then is left as a poor legacy. So, we do have to try and pull all this together and say, well, yes, the organising committee has got a job to do and very important, but let's be realistic in what is sustainable in the longer term and get a good name for events rather than leave some of the bad taste that often happens.
Thank you, Ian. I got the sign that we need to close, so thank you very much, the panelists, for these interesting statements. Thank you for listening. And I think everybody deserves a nice coffee break.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Speaking of innovations in event infrastructure, this building, this room, auditorium will shortly be divided into two for the round tables. We've got one side for sport events, one for cities, and there's also the culture round table upstairs. That takes place in 30 minutes from now. So enjoy your coffee break and look forward to more interactive discussion. Thank you.